This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. Many thanks to the Lannan Foundation and to Marge Piercy for inviting me to take part in this program. That this is an honor goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. It is my honor to introduce a major American writer tonight. Marge Piercy was born March 31st, 1936, into a working-class family in Detroit, Michigan. She was the first in her family to go to college, receiving a bachelor's degree from the University of Michigan and a master's degree from Northwestern University. However, she would evolve into that rarest of creatures, the writer who is not an academic. She always knew the meaning of work. She worked as a secretary, a switchboard operator, a department store clerk, and an artist model. She worked for civil rights, the rights of women, against the war in Vietnam. She worked as a key organizer for Students for a Democratic Society. Her first book, a collection of poems called Breaking Camp, was published in 1968. Over the last 40 years, Marge Piercy has published 40 books, 17 novels, 17 collections of poetry, 5 works of nonfiction, and 1 play. More about the play in a moment. Indeed, she is best known as a novelist thanks to celebrated works such as Woman on the Edge of Time, Braided Lives, Gone to Soldiers, and The Longings of Women. However, she is equally accomplished as a poet, as reflected in such works as The Moon is Always Female, considered a feminist classic, Circles on the Water, her selected poems, The Art of Blessing the Day, her collection of poems with Jewish themes, and most recently, The Crooked Inheritance. Many of these books will be available in the lobby after the event, and I fully expect a stampede to the book table. Marge Piercy has earned numerous honors, including the Golden Rose, the oldest poetry award in the country from the New England Poetry Club, the Arthur C. Clarke Award for the best science fiction novel published in the United Kingdom, the Patterson Poetry Prize for The Art of Blessing the Day, a National Endowment for the Arts Creative Writing Fellowship, and, most recently, induction into the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. I still remember my first encounter with her work. I had just graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison with a degree in history. Wielding the economic power of my degree like a mighty sword, I soon found myself on welfare. One of my few sanctuaries was the local Radical bookstore. There, I found a play by Marge Piercy and her husband, Ira Wood, called The Last White Class, about a black family in a white neighborhood during the days of busing in Boston. I was mesmerized. Yet, I could not afford to buy the book, and I could not, in good conscience, steal the book. Instead, I would tiptoe into the bookstore, read some scenes from the play, hide the book, then come back to read more. The Last White Class became a cliffhanger. Finally, I returned to the bookstore to read Act 2, Scene 9, the final scene, and discovered to my horror that someone else had bought the book. I had to wait 10 years to finish that play. Over time, however, it was the poetry of Marge Piercy that moved me most deeply, and it is that poetry you will hear tonight. This is poetry of fierce principle, poetry with an ethical imperative, based on the idea of tikkun olam, the Jewish concept of rebuilding the world. This is not only political poetry, but poetry that encompasses the range of human experience. There are poems of protest, but also poems of love, sex, nature, and cats. There is anger, but also celebration and even humor. Marge Piercy is funny, a social satirist of the first order. Not surprisingly, the storytelling skills of this novelist carry over into her poetry. There are so many striking narratives, poems that flicker on screen in the mind's eye like small movies. Indeed, this is poetry of the well-chiseled image of the senses and the body, tactile and vivid. Given the content of these poems, it would be easy to overlook how much craft is present here. Marge Piercy is an absolute artisan of metaphor and simile. This is also poetry of startling clarity, clarity of vision and clarity of language. Attention is love, she writes, and you get it. This is most welcome in an age when the aesthetic of obscurity dominates the poetic landscape. I think of Woody Allen's fictional poet, Sean O'Shawn, who was considered, quote, the most incomprehensible and hence the finest poet of his time. What you will hear tonight is different and far better. Carolyn Kaiser says, when you see her name in the table of contents of a magazine, you turn at once to her poem, story, or essay. When you see her book in the store, you buy it before reading the reviews, knowing that this work is necessary to your enlightenment and survival. It's a short list: Nadine Gordimer, Adrian Rich, Margaret Atwood, and Marge Piercy. Warm, sensuous, human, earthy, yet a disciplined artist and a woman with something to tell you. Piercy is one of these women, and yet her own unique and original self. I'd know that voice anywhere. In fact, the voice of Marge Piercy is many voices. Think of Whitman in number 24 of Song of Myself, through me many long dumb voices, voices veiled, and I remove the veil. These poems crackle with silenced voices, living and dead, the voices of women and girls, immigrants, dissenters, lovers, ghosts from the Holocaust to the Iraq War. Now, those voices will fill this auditorium, singing in one strong voice. Please welcome my friend, Marge Piercy.
Should think it's a little, whoops, this isn't my book. It's what I'm reading. I shall read from the travels of Captain Cook on the Endeavor, which is the book I'm reading. Okay. This is the oldest of my poems that I still read regularly. It's had a funny afterlife, being read at the memorials for activists and radical lawyers and union leaders. To be of use. The people I love the best jump into work head first without dallying in the shallows and swim off with sure strokes, almost out of sight. They seem to become natives of that element, the black, sleek heads of seals bouncing like half-submerged balls. I love people who harness themselves, an ox to a heavy cart, who pull like water buffalo with massive patience, who strain in the mud and the muck to move things forward, who do what has to be done again and again. I want to be with people who submerge in the task, who go into the fields to harvest and work in a row and pass the bags along, who are not parlor generals and field deserters, but move in a common rhythm when the food must come in or the fire be put out. The work of the world is common as mud. Botched, it smears the hands, crumbles to dust. But the thing Worth doing, well done, has a shape that satisfies, clean and evident. Hopi vases that held corn are put in museums, but you know they were made to be used. The pitcher cries for water to carry, and the person for work that is real. If you feel like applauding at the end, I'll be absolutely delighted. But if you applaud sometimes, not other times, I wonder why you don't applaud the other times. Plus, I like it if you will respond to the poems emotionally rather than this way and try to and take some energy away with you. If you feel you have to, you have to, but I don't think you gotta. This is called Tracks. The small birds leave cuneiform messages on the snow. I have been here. I am hungry. I must eat. Where I dropped seeds, they scraped down to pine needles and frozen sand. Sometimes when snow flickers past the windows, muffles trees and bushes, buries the path, the jays come knocking with their beaks on my bedroom window. To them, I am made of seeds. To the cats, I am mother and lover, lap and toy, cook and cleaner. To the coyotes, I am chaser and shouter. To the crows, watcher, protector. To the possums, the foxes, the skunks, a shadow passing, a moment's wind. I was bad, watchful mummy to one man. To another, I was forgiving sister whose hand poured out honey and aloe. To that woman, I was a gale whose lashing waves threatened her foundation. To this one, an oak to her flowering vine. I have worn the faces, the masks of hieroglyphs, gods and demons, bat-faced ghosts, sibyls and thieves. Lover, loser, red rose and ragweed. These are the tracks I have left on the white crust of time. What are big girls made of? The construction of a woman. A woman is not made of flesh, of bone and sinew, belly and breasts, elbows and liver and toe. She is manufactured like a sports sedan. She is retooled, refitted, and redesigned every decade. Cecile had been seduction itself in college. She wriggled through bars like a satin eel, her hips and ass promising, her mouth pursed in the dark red lipstick of desire. She visited in 68, still wearing skirts tight to the knees, dark red lipstick, while I danced through Manhattan in miniskirt, lipstick pale as apricot milk, hair loose as a horse's mane. Oh, dear, I thought in my superiority of the moment, what has happened to poor Cecile? She was out of fashion, out of the game, disqualified, disdained, dismembered from the club of desire. Look at pictures in French fashion magazines of the 18th century, century of the ultimate lady, fantasy wrought of silk and corseting. Panniers bring her hips out 3 feet each way while the waist is pinched and the belly flattened under wood. The breasts are stuffed up and out, offered like apples in a bowl. The tiny foot is encased in a slipper never meant for walking. On top is a grandiose headache, hair like a museum piece, daily ornamented with ribbons, vases, grottos, mountains, frigates in full sail, balloons, baboons, the fancy of a hairdresser turned loose. The hats were Rococo wedding cakes that would dim the Las Vegas Strip. Here is a woman forced into shape, rigid exoskeleton, torturing flesh, a woman made of pain. How superior we are now. See the modern woman, thin as a blade of scissors. She runs on a treadmill every morning, fits herself into machines of weights and pulleys to heave and grunt, an image in her mind she can never approximate, a body of rosy glass that never wrinkles, never grows, never fades. She sits at the table, closing her eyes to food, hungry, always hungry. A woman made of pain. A cat or dog approaches another. They sniff noses. They bristle or lick. They fall in love as often as we do, as passionately. But they fall in love or lust with furry flesh, not hoop skirts or push-up bras, rib removal or liposuction. It is not for male or female dogs that poodles are clipped to topiary hedges. If only we could like each other raw. If only we could love ourselves like healthy babies burbling in our arms. If only we were not programmed and reprogrammed to need what is sold us. Why should we want to live inside ads? Why should we want to scourge our softness to straight lines like a Modrian painting? Why should we punish each other with scorn, as if to have a large ass were worse than being greedy or mean? When will women not be compelled to view their bodies as science projects, gardens to be weeded, dogs to be trained? When will a woman cease to be made of pain? This is a poem that, by the way, if I pant a little bit, you got to understand, I live at sea level. I walk across the stage and I'm going, here. And climbing steps, forget about it. When I wrote this poem, I thought it was about my mother. I've since learned that in many ways it's about a lot of people's mothers, grandmothers, a lot of people. It's called Putting the Good Things Away. In the drawer were folded fine batiste slips embroidered with scrolls and posies, edged with handmade lace too good for her to wear. Daily she put on schmatas fit only to wash the car or the windows, rags that had never been pretty, even when new. Somewhere just dresses are sold only to women without money to waste on themselves, on pleasure, to women who hate their bodies, to women whose lives close on them. Such dresses come bleached by tears, packed in salt like herring. Yet she put the good things away for the good day that must surely come, when promises would open like tulips their satin cups for her to drink the sweet sacramental wine of fulfillment. The story shown in her as through tinted glass, how the mother gave up and did without and was in the end crowned with what, scallions? Crowned queen of the dead place in the heart where old dreams whistle on bone flutes, where run-over pets are forgotten. In the coffin she was beautiful, not because of the undertaker's garish cosmetics, but because that face at 80 was still her face at 18, peering over the drab long dress of poverty, clutching a book. Where did you read your dreams, mother? Because her expression softened from the pucker of disappointment, the grimace of swallowed rage, she looked a white-haired girl. The anger turned inward. The anger turned inward. Where could it go except to make pain? It flowed into me with her milk. Her anger annealed me. I was dipped into the cauldron of boiling rage and rose, a warrior and a witch, but still vulnerable there where she held me. She could always wound me, for she knew the secret places. She could always touch me, for she knew the pressure points of pleasure and pain. Our minds were woven together. I gave her presents, and she hid them away wrapped in plastic. Too good, she said. Too good. I'm saving them. So after her death, I sort them, the ugly things that were sufficient for every day, and the pretty things for which no day of hers was ever good enough. Choose a color. Between red and dead, we live frightened, crouching, covering, signing loyalty oaths. The war they call cold froze our brains. The Russians were coming to burn our flags and steal our color TVs. Between green and machine, the ozone fades away, scorching our flesh. Ice caps seep into the sea. Hurricanes come in quick posses, drought or torrent. Between blue and Prozac, who will you be? The brooks are gray with antibiotics, antidepressants, painkillers. The fish sleep upside down. This pill will make you inane. Between lavender and hellfire, preachers froth. Get saved again, again, yet it still itches. In the dark, what you really want licks your thighs, burns hot in your brain. Between white and night, dark faces invade your entitlement. They are stealing your birthright to stomp and swell. Why can't the world be peopled by only you? Pick a color, any color, from zero to infinity, from blood to cancer, from war to Armageddon, from AIDS to bone, from here to no one, on a very fast jet. This is called The Good, the Bad, and the Inconvenient. Gardening is often a measured cruelty. What is to live and what is to be torn up by its roots and flung on the compost to rot and give its essence to new soil. It is not only the weeds I seize. I go down the row of new spinach, their little bright bees crowding, and snatch every other, flinging their little bodies just as healthy, just as sound as their neighbors, but judged by me, superfluous. We all commit crimes too small for us to measure. The ant soldiers we stomp, whose only aim was to protect, to feed their vast family. It is I who decide which beetles are good and which are bad. As if each is not whole in its kind. We eat to live and so do they, the locusts, the grasshoppers, the flea beetles and aphids and slugs. By bad, I mean inconvenient. Nothing we do is simple without consequence, and each act is shadowed with death. What noises it makes. Sort of my own private thunder. You want rain? You're getting at least thunder. Oh, if I had that book, I could read you that rainbow. But I don't have it with me. Too bad. Ah. That would have been a good poem to read here. Oh, well. Win some, lose some. This is a sadly true poem, A Day in the Life. She is wakened at 4 a.m. Of course, she does not pick up, but listens through the answering machine to the male voice promising she will burn in hell. At 7, she opens her door. A dead cat is hammered to her porch, brown tabby, hit by a car, no collar. She hugs her own Duke of Orange. She cannot let him out. She has her car locked in a neighbor's garage, safe from pipe bombs, but she must walk there. She drives to work a circuitous route, never the same way twice. Outside the clinic, three men walk in circles with photos of six-month fetuses. They surround her car. They are forbidden the parking lot, but the police don't care. They bang on her hood. As she gets out, they bump and jostle her. One thrusts his sign into her face. She protects her eyes. Something hard strikes her back. Inside, she sighs, turns on the lights, the air conditioning, the coffee machine. The security system is always on. The funds for teenage contraception gone into metal detectors. She answers the phone. Is this where you killed babies? The second call, a woman is weeping. The day begins. A girl raped by her stepfather, a harried mother with too many children and diabetes, a terrified teenager who does not know how it happened, a woman with an injunction against an abuser. All day she takes their calls. All day she checks them in, takes medical histories, holds hands, dries tears, hears secrets and lies and horrors, soothes, continues. Every time a new patient walks in, a tinny voice whispers, "Is this the one carrying a handgun with an automatic weapon with a knife?" She sits exposed. She answers the phone. "I'm going to cut your throat, you murderer," she says. "Have a nice day." A bomb threat is called in. She has to empty the clinic. The police finally come. There is no bomb. The doctor tells her how they are stalking his daughter. Then she goes home to Duke, eats a late supper by the TV. Her mother calls. Her boyfriend comes over. She cries in his arms. He is, she can tell, getting tired of her tears. Next morning she rises and day falls on her like a truckload of wet cement. This is a true story. This is what I know of virtue. This is what I know of goodness in our time. I am not a poet who is anti-technology. I am attached to my cell phone by an umbilical cord and to my computer. But I do not love lots of different kinds of technology. This is called All Systems Are Up. You dial and a voice answers. After you have stammered a reply into dead air, you realize it cannot hear or know you. The pre-programmed voice of a thing addresses you as a retarded dog. "Press 0 if you wish to be connected to emergency services. Press 1 to order a product. Press 2 to speak to an agent. Press 3 if you need assistance. Have a nice day." I press 3. I need information. Another robot says, "Press 1 if you wish to order a product. Press 2 to speak to an agent. Press 3 if you need further assistance." I press 3. The voice says, "You have pressed 3. That is not a valid number. Please press 4 and make another choice." I press 4. The canned voice speaks. "Press 3 if you desire euthanasia. Press 2 if you wish to detonate. Press 1 never to have been born. Press 0 if you intend universal Armageddon. Have a nice day." I think I will do one rain poem. Maybe it'll help. The rain is wine. It is a ripe rain, coming down in big fat drops like grapes dropping on the roof, white grapes round as moons. It is coming in waves whooshing through the trees, silvery intimate, it softens and washes the parched air. It falls on my face like a blessing. It sweetens my body, rolling down my upstretched arms. The rain blesses us as it opens the cracked earth, as it opens us to itself, the sweet gush of August rain. This is a poem about something that happened coming home from a reading late at night. The Taconic is just a parkway in New York, close to Massachusetts. Every year I teach at a place called Omega, and we take it home, because that's how you get up to the Mass Pike. So this was in September. It's called Taconic at Midnight. It's one of those funny things that happens that feels very mystical or something. At 11, we headed home north on the Taconic Parkway to the Mass Pike, a mild late September night with fog drifting in great hanks like white Spanish moss, wavering in translucent banners across the narrow highway, diffusing moonlight, deflecting our beams. Almost at once, we began to see them. Deer congregated on each side where the woods opened, dozens in a clearing, bucks in the road, does milling about. We drove slower and slower, inching past, steering among them who ignored our intrusion. They were intent on each other, for this gathering was a mating mart, like a mixer, But they were serious, examining each other with desperate attention, an air of silky, sexy tension rolling like the fog that sank and lifted, bedazzling their sleek flanks, their shaking antlers. The road did not belong. It should have been rolled up like a bale of wire and stowed, for this was a night of the ancient gods, when America floated on the turtle's back, and all things were still pristine, that lucent brown doe, round eye of a virgin doe. This is called No One Came Home. I live in a village. Most of the year is about 3,000 of us. In summer, it goes up to 23,000. But even where I live, there was a woman killed in the first plane. She was going out to California because her son, who's named Elvis, his band had a real gig for the first time, and she was going to the opening. One. Max was in bed that morning, pressed against my feet, walking to my pillow to kiss my nose, long and lean with aquamarine eyes, my son Prince, who thought himself my lover. He was cream and golden orange, strong, well, lord of the other cats in his domain. He lay on my chest staring into my eyes. He went out at noon. He never came back. A smear of blood on the grass at the side of the road where we saw a huge coyote the next evening. We knew he had been eaten, yet we could not know. We kept looking for him, calling him, searching. He vanished from our lives in an hour. My cats have always died in old age, slowly with abundant warning. Not Max. He left a hole in my waking. Two. A woman leaves her children in daycare. I'm trying to read. A woman leaves her children in daycare, goes off to her secretarial job on the 100th floor, conscientious always to arrive early because she needs the money for her children, for health insurance, for rent and food and clothing and fees, for all the things kids need whose father has two new children and a great lawyer. They are going to eat chicken that night, she has promised, and the kids talk of that together, fried chicken with adobo, rice and black beans, food rich as their love. The day is bright as a clean mirror. Three. His wife has morning sickness, so does not rise for breakfast. He stops for coffee or yogurt, rushing for the 808 train. Ignoring the window, he writes the 5 pages, the novel that is going to make him famous. Cut him loose from the desk where he's chained to the phone 8 to 10 hours, making cold calls. In his head, naval battles rage. He's been studying Midway, the Coral Sea, Guadalcanal. He can recite tonnage, tides, the problems with torpedoes. For 5 years, he has prepared. His makeshift office in the basement is lined with books and maps. His book will sing with bravery and error. The day is blue and whistles like a robin. Four. His father was a fireman and his brother. He once imagined being a rapper, but at the end of high school, he knew it was his calling. It was his family way. As there are trapeze families, clans who perform with tigers or horses, the Irish travelers, tinkers, gypsies, those born to work the earth of their farm, and those who inherit vast fortunes built of the bones of others. So families inherit danger and grace, the pursuit of the safety of others before their own. The morning smell of the river, of donuts, of coffee, of leaves. Five. When a man fell into the molten steel, the company would deliver an ingot to bury. Something. Where I live on the Cape, lost at sea means nobody. You can't bury a coffin length of seawater. There are stones in our graveyards with lists of names, sailors from ships gone down in a storm. MIA means nobody, no answer. Hope that is hopeless, the door that can never be quite closed. Lives are broken off like tree limbs in a storm. Other lives simply dissolve like salt in warm water, and there is no shadow on the pavement, no trace. They puff into nothing, We can't believe. We die still expecting an answer. 6. Los desaparecidos, did we notice? Did we care? In Chile, funded, assisted by the CIA, a democratic government was torn down and thousands brought into a stadium and never seen again. Reports of torture, reports of graves in the mountains, bodies dumped at sea, reports of your wife, your son, your father, arrested and then vanished like cigarette smoke. Gone like a whisper you aren't quite sure you heard. A living person who must be somewhere, anywhere, lost, wounded, boxed in a cell, in exile, under a stone, somewhere. Bones, a skull, a button, a wisp of cloth. In Argentina, the women marched for those who had disappeared. Did we notice? That happened in those places, those other places where people don't speak English, eat strange spicy foods, have dictators or communists or sambas or goas. They didn't count. We didn't count them. Or those they said had been there alive and now who knew? Not us. The terror has come home. Will it make us better or worse? 7. When will we understand what terrorists never believe, that we are all precious in our loving, all tender in our flesh and webbed together, that no one should be torn out of the fabric of friends and family, the sweet and sour work of loving, burnt anonymously, carelessly, because of nothing they ever did, because of hatred they never knew, because of nobody they ever touched, turned suddenly to dust on a perfect September morning, bright as a new apple, when nothing they did would ever again make any difference. Ever try to get a recipe from anybody in your family? This is called My Mother Gives Me Her Recipe. Take some flour, 2-3 cups, and you cut in the butter. Now, some women, they make it with shortening, but I say butter even though that means you have to have it with fish, see? You cut up some apples, not those stupid sweet ones. Apples for the cake, they have to have some bite, you know. A little sour in the sweet, like love. You slice them into little moons. No, like half a crescent moons, you aren't listening. You mix sugar and cinnamon and cloves. Some women use allspice till it's dark. Then you stir in the apples. You coat every little moon. Did I say you add milk? Oh, just till it feels right. Use your hands. Milk in the cake part. Then you pat it into a pan. I like round ones. I forgot to say you add baking powder. Did I forget lemon on the apples? Then you just bake it. Well, till it's done, of course. Did I remember you placed the apples in rows? You can make a pattern like a weave. It's pretty that way. I like things pretty. It's just a simple cake. Any fool can make it except your aunt. I gave her the recipe, but she never got it right. I did finally, I've adapted it from Jenny Grossinger's cookbook and finally worked through till I got the cake. No thanks to my mother. Love's clay. Love is a lumpy thing. Falling in love is like peacock tails. Fountains of rose petals, always music underneath, like a movie crescendoing. Love is cutting onions for supper when you're already tired. Love is patched of hope and habit and desire, a tent mended nightly. Love is tough as a bone you gnaw and suck out the marrow. Love is a bone of which you make soup and surprise it sustains you. Infatuation is fun, a tango in a grove of mirrors. Love is just work, what you do one day after the next, like bricks laid end to end. And in the end, infatuation leaves you with a sticky, sweet residue in the bottom of the glass. And love is all you'll remember as you're dying. This is called Woman in a Shoe. There was an old woman who lived in a shoe, her own two shoes. Men's they were brown and worn. They flapped when she hobbled along. There was an old woman who lived in a refrigerator box under the expressway with her cat. January, they died curled together. There was an old woman who lived in a room under the roof. It got hot, but she was scared to open the window. It got hotter. Too hot, too cold, too poor, too old. Invisible unless she annoys you. Invisible unless she gets in your way. In fairy tales, if you're kind to an old woman, she gives you the thing you desperately need. An unconquerable sword, a purse bottomless and always filled, a magical ring. We don't believe that. Such tales were made up by old women scared to be thrust from the hearth, shoved into the street to starve. Who fears an old woman pushing a grocery cart? She's talking to God as she shuffles along, her life in her pockets. You are the true child of her heart, and you see living garbage. This is called Colors Passing Through Us. Purple as tulips in May, mauve into lush velvet. Purple as a stained blackberry's leave on the lips, on the hands. The purple of ripe grapes, sunlit and warm as flesh. Every day I will give you a color like a new flower in a bud vase on your desk. Every day I will paint you as women color each other with henna on hands and on feet. Red as henna, as cinnamon, as coals after the fire is banked. The cardinal in the feeder, roses tumbling on the arbor, their weight bending the wood. The red of the syrup I make from their petals. Orange as a perfumed fruit hanging their globes on the glossy tree. Orange as pumpkins in the field. Orange as butterfly weed and the monarchs who come to eat it. Orange as my cat running live through the high grass. Yellow as a goat's wise and wicked eyes. Yellow as a hell of daffodils. Yellow as dandelions by the highway. Yellow as butter and egg yolks. Yellow as a school bus stopping you. Yellow as a slicker in a downpour. Here is my bouquet, here is a sing-song of all the things you make me think of. Here is oblique praise for the height and depth of you and the width, too. Here is my box of new crayons at your feet. Green as mint jelly, green as a frog on a lily pad twanging, the green of coast lettuce upright about to bolt into opulent towers, green as Grand Chartreuse in a clear glass, green as wine bottles. Blue as cornflowers, delphiniums, bachelor's buttons. Blue as Roquefort, blue as saga, blue as still water. Blue as the eyes of a Siamese cat. Blue as shadows on new snow, as a spring azure is sipping from a puddle on the blacktop. Cobalt as the midnight sky, when day is gone without a trace. And we lie in each other's arms, eyes shut and fingers open. And all the colors of the world pass through our bodies like strings of fire. This is called Deadlocked Wedlock. Marriage is one man and one woman, they say, one at a time, then another, another. You see the buff faces of old men shining with money as they lead their young blondes and toddlers, second or third family, the shop-worn wives donated to Goodwill. It has always been so, they say, one man and one woman in the Bible, like Jacob with Leah and Rachel and the bondmaidens dropping children, his four women competing to swell like a galaxy of moons. In Tibet, women had various husbands at once. I had two myself for a few years. In earlier times, in different cultures and tribes, men married men and women married women, and the sky never fell. People lived as they would and must, and the rivers still ran clean, and the grass grew a lot harder and more abundantly than it does for us. What damage does love do in the soft gray evenings when the rain drifts like pigeon feathers across the sky and into the trees? Why, gentlemen, do you fear two women who walk holding hands with their child? 2 50-year-old men exchange rings and kiss, and you catch mad cow disease? What do you hate when you watch lovers? What are you really missing? I realized I had become an adult when I stopped having the recurring nightmare where I have signed up for a class and it's the finals, but I forgot to go to it. And I began to have the recurring nightmare where I've gotten on the wrong plane and I go to not the place I'm supposed to go for a reading, but some totally wrong place. This is called Traveling Dream. I am packing to go to the airport, but somehow I am never packed. I keep remembering more things I keep forgetting. Secretly, the clock is bolting forward 10 minutes at a click instead of one. Each time I look away, it jumps. Now I remember I have to find the cats. I have 5 cats, even when I'm asleep. One is on the bed, and I slip them her into the suitcase. One is under the sofa. I drag him out, but the tabby in the suitcase has vanished. Now my tickets have run away. Maybe the cat has my tickets. I can only find 1 cat. My purse has gone into hiding. And now it is time to get packed. I take the suitcase down. There is a cat in it, but no clothes. My tickets are floating in the bathtub full of water. I dry them. 1 cat is in my purse, but my wallet has dissolved. The tickets are still dripping. I look at the clock as it leaps forward and see I have missed my plane. My bed is gone now. There is 1 cat the size of a sofa. This is called Report of the 14th Subcommittee on Convening a Discussion Group. This is how things begin to tilt into change, how conditions are knit from strands of hair, of barbed wire twine, knitting wool and gut, how people ease into action, arguing each inch. Oh, but the tedium of it, watching granite erode. Let us meet to debate meeting, the day, the time, the length. We will discuss whether we will sit or stand or hang from the ceiling or take it lying down. Let us argue about the chair and the table and the chairperson and the motion to table the chair. In the room, fog gathers under the ceiling and thickens in every brain. Let us form committees, spawning subcommittees, all laying little moldy eggs of reports. Under the gray fluorescent sun, they will crack to hatch scuttling lizards of more committees. The Pliocene gathers momentum and fades. The earth tilts on its axis. More and more snows fall each winter and less melt each spring. A new ice age is pressing the glaciers forward over the floor. We watch the wall of ice advance. We are evolving into mollusks, barnacles, clinging to wood and plastic, metal and smoke, while the stale and flotsam-laden red tide of rhetoric inches up the shingles and dawdles back. This is true virtue, to sit here and stay awake. To listen, to argue, to wade on through the muck, wrestling to some momentary small argument like a pinhead pearl prized from a dragon oyster. I believe in this democracy as I believe there's blood in my veins, but oh, in me lurks a tyrant with a double-bladed axe who longs to swing it wide and shining, longs to stand up and shriek, "You shall do as I say, pig bastards, no more committees, but only picnics and orgies and dances. I have spoken, so be it forevermore." This is called The Low Road. I retired this poem for a while because I felt it was too 60s and 70s, but I'm bringing it back. The Low Road. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up, they can bust you, they can break your fingers, they can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs so you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wall up your lover. They can do anything you can't stop them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight, you can refuse, you can take what revenge you can, but they roll over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity in your own newsletter. 10,000 power in your own paper. 100,000 your own media. 10 million your own country. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day you mean one more. That's an old organizer's poem. I was a good organizer. I'm retired, mostly. Though I go to enough meetings, God help me. But organizing is so much more important than rhetoric. It's the bread and butter of change. And the last poem I'm going to read is The Art of Blessing the Day. This is the blessing for rain after drought. Come down, wash the air so it shimmers. A perfume shawl of lavender chiffon. Let the parched leaves suckle and swell. Enter my skin, wash me for the little chrysalis of sleep rocked in your plashing. In the morning the world is peeled, is shining. This is a blessing for sun after long rain. Now everything shakes itself free and rises. The trees are bright as pushcart ices. Every last lily opens its satin thighs. The bees dance and roll in pollen, and the cardinal at the top of the pine sings at full throttle, fountaining. This is a blessing for a ripe peach. This is luck made round. Frost can nip the blossom, kill the bee. It can drop a hard, green, useless nut. Brown fungus, the burrowing worm that coils in rot, can blemish it and wind crush it to the ground. Yet this peach fills my mouth with juicy sun. This is the blessing for the first garden tomato. Those green boxes of tasteless acid the store sells in January, those red things with a savor of wet chalk, they mock your fragrant name. How fat and sweet you are, weighing down my palm, warm as the flank of a cow in the sun. You are the savor of summer in a thin red skin. This is the blessing for a political victory. Although I shall not forget that things work in increments and epicycles and sometime leaps that half the time fall back down, let's not relinquish dancing while the music fits into our hips and bounces our heels. We must never forget pleasure is real as pain. The blessing for the return of a favorite cat, the blessing for love returned, for friends returned, for money received unexpected, the blessing for the rising of the bread, the sun, the oppressed. I am not sentimental about old men mumbling the Hebrew by rote with no more feeling than one says Gesundheit. But the discipline of blessings is to taste each moment, the bitter, the sour, the sweet, and the salty, and be glad for what does not hurt. The art is in compressing attention to each little and big blossom of the tree of life, to let the tongue sing each fruit, its savor, its aroma, and its use. Attention is love. What we must give children, mothers, fathers, pets, our friends, the news, the woes of others. What we want to change, we curse and then pick up a tool. Bless whatever you can with eyes and hands and tongue. If you can't bless it, get ready to make it new. Thank you.
The reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I'm going to put this away before I forget it. Along with Captain.
Well, we're back. And where to begin?
Clemente.
Clemente, yes. I put this to my son Clemente, who's 17 years old. If you had one question to ask Marge, what would it be? And he said, if your husband suddenly turned into a parakeet, would you still love him?
To which I said, yes, I would, but the cats would eat him.
And speaking of cats... Now, I too am an animal lover. I have shared living quarters with every imaginable beast.
Including those you didn't love.
Yes.
The python.
Yes, the python. Parrots, ferrets, an iguana, tortoise, rather tragic hedgehog. All because I was forbidden pets in the housing projects where I grew up. But in your memoir, you tell us, my life has a spine of cats. What is... a spine of cats.
Well, look, I teach personal narrative along with Woody, with Ironwood, a lot. And we tell people, you can't tell your whole life. It would take as long as it did to live it and be very boring. It would be full of aimless conversations, television shows you watched, what you had for lunch, who's the arguments about who's going to do the dishes. You have to have an organizing principle, especially in a memoir. Now, I could write three other memoirs with different organizing principles, but I chose that one because I wanted the first memoir I was writing. I was 65 and decided to write a memoir, and was about my emotional life mostly, not my political life, not my literary life, but the core. And I organized it around the cats I've had, because I've had cats since I was a little girl. My mother liked cats, so she didn't like female cats. She thought they were sluts. And none of our cats was ever altered, so they almost all came to terrible ends, which is part of why I do my best to spoil my cats. But through my life, I've always lived with cats. I communicate with cats very well. Woody says I talk cat.
Let's talk humor.
Yes, sir.
Being funny is serious business.
Well, being serious is serious business, too.
But people are surprised to learn that being funny is indeed serious business and hard work. Do you deliberately use humor as a political tool to lower the defenses of your audience and subversively smuggle across a message?
I'd never do anything so subversive.
No.
I believe I always shape readings, and I believe that when you've done some heavy stuff, it's good to do a light poem because otherwise you lose your audience. It's like the problem you do too many love poems in a row. People start thinking about their relationships and they're gone. But I also look... It's a very Jewish thing, using humor when you're serious, using humor to make funny points, finding something funny you can laugh about when the shit hits the fan. That's instinctive to me. I think I survived my childhood by being a bratty kid who made jokes and remarks and so forth. And I got in a lot of trouble because I had a great big mouth. I got beaten up a lot for that. But I would have gotten beaten up anyhow. It's part of how I deal with the world.
How do you know when a poem works as humor? I mean, does the audience tell you, or
You read it to him. Yeah. For me, a poem is not finished until I've performed it. Mm-hmm. Poems to me are arrangements of sounds and silences, and when you play it to an audience for the first time, you hear all the parts that don't work. Whether the audience responds or not, you hear the parts where you faked it, the parts where it came apart, where you didn't really do it.
You've written political poems and you've written political pamphlets. What's the difference between poetry and pamphleteering?
Agitprop aims to get people to do a specific thing. It has to be short, to the point, clear, and it's aimed, let's say you want people to come out for a specific demonstration, you want people to do a certain thing. Poetry and novels don't do that. A novel takes 2-3 years to write. If you were trying to get people to do something, they would be long gone by the time you finished it, and another year before it's published. And poems don't work that way. They don't get people to go out and go boom, boom. When you're writing poetry, you can move people. People can hear in the poems things that they feel or thought that they weren't, that becomes clarified for them. So it enables people to be clearer politically, emotionally, personally about their lives, maybe to feel less guilty about things they're feeling, maybe to feel more strongly about what they're thinking. It affects internally that way. It doesn't get people out in the street.
This all goes to the craft of political poetry.
We live in a time of an enormous heresy. In art, the Rockefellers promoted it. It's been going on for quite a while. Imagine telling Blake that there was no point to politics. Imagine telling that to Shakespeare. Imagine telling it to Catullus. Imagine telling it to any of the writers, to Byron or Shelley. To try and tell any of them that you can't be political. What? But I'm a human being. Why can't I be political? I have political thoughts. I have the same duties as any other citizen. It's ridiculous to imagine that political poetry is any different from love poetry, nature poetry, poetry about your left foot. I mean, it's just, it's a dimension of the human condition to be political. And if you opt out of it, you opt out of a lot of what comes and gets you.
Answer. You've often heard people say, well, you can write about anything. Well, just not that.
Yeah, well, that's what it amounts to. You really can write about anything you pay enough attention to.
You're not only a political poet, you're one of the few writers in this country who makes a living outside of academia. And yet you call it a precarious living.
Well, it ain't easy.
Well, it's raising an obvious question then. Why not allow yourself to be embraced by the voracious giant squid of academia?
I was in graduate school. I'd gone through the University of Michigan, magna cum laude. I got a fellowship. I went to Northwestern because they gave me the most money. I put myself up for sale as a graduate student. And that was where they paid me to go. I mean, otherwise I couldn't have gone. And I really did ace it all. I mean, I took their graduate exam and got the highest score they'd ever gotten to that point. The trouble is I'd started thinking of MLA papers and not poems and not novels. Plus, I knew that I would never do the work that I was supposed to do if I stayed in academia. I didn't come from the middle class. I wanted to write about things that you weren't supposed to write about, that weren't supposed to be interesting. I knew that I would perish in a certain way. I would become somebody else, and I would betray what I was supposed to be. So I went down to the bottom of Chicago, lived in shitholes, did all kinds of odd jobs for a whole lot of years, and tried to learn to write the way I had to learn to write. Because there were no political novels written by women. There were no, the eyes of ordinary women were not considered the stuff of literature.
So you live by your writing and you live by the gigs.
Yeah. By now, especially gigs.
Yeah. Well, all right. So here's the flip side to the last question about making a living. You don't get to read for the Lannan Foundation at the Lenzic Theater every night.
I'd like to.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a whole lot of other other poems and several novels.
So, if you could pick your worst gig of all time, what would it be?
Okay, well, there was the time that I was brought into Cleveland to do a benefit, but the guy who was supposed to be doing the publicity got the flu and never bothered telling anybody he hadn't done any publicity, so I came in and read to the six people on the organizing committee. But that wasn't my worst reading. Then there was the time that I was introduced in Lake Forest, Illinois, by the head of the English department, who said, our poet tonight is Marge Piercy. I never heard of her, but the younger faculty made me invite her. Then there was a reading I gave in Brockport, New York, in March, where half the audience was sitting there texting. But the worst reading of all was when I came into Nashville to go to Austin Peay University. Well, by the way, it must be wonderful to go to the football games and hear them say, go Peay! Go Peay! At PU. But no, so I were coming in on the plane, and we're coming down. We suddenly go whoops way up in the air, and then we go whoops way down in the air, and whoops way up. And finally, we come in for a pancake landing, and I'm shaking. Everyone's shaking. It's worst. I've been in some bad plane things, but that was the worst. So we come in there, come out. Look, it's pouring rain, and the lights are flickering in the airport. And fortunately, my driver was a woman from Detroit. Now, you survived Detroit, you're a good driver. We get out of there, and we come out on the expressway to the airport, heading to PU. And the first thing we see on the expressway is a six-wheeler on its side. And then we see all the signs on the expressway are down, and she has to drive around them. And we look and we see, this is Nashville, this is the Nashville tornado. We see the funnel cloud that has just passed over right through the middle of town, hit a couple of skyscrapers. We see it. We drove, I don't know how she drove on that road. It was unbelievable. But she got us there, they were almost there, and then the river was flooded. So we had to go around the river being flooded to get to PU. And then when we get there, there's no electricity on the campus. So they found a candle. So and by the time we got there, most of the audience had left in terror. So in an auditorium without electricity or lighting, reading, I read by a candle to about 20 people. And then she drove me back. By that time, the tornado was over. I thought, well, I'm going to get to the motel. Oh, it'll be wonderful. It's a Holiday Inn by the airport. The electricity. No electricity. No electricity. No air conditioning. No water. That was my worst reading.
And this is why you cannot live by gigs alone. So you work in multiple genres. And that's something I'm only learning to do now. I'm currently working on a screenplay called Night of the Living Dead Poets Society.
That's the one thing I've never done is a screenplay.
Okay.
Because Woody did it. My Ira Wood did it. And I learned what it's like when you work for a Hollywood producer and they're playing this game with you. You write a screenplay that will match what I'm thinking of. I can't describe it or tell you about it, but you have to do it.
Now, how does working in all those genres keep you from developing the dreaded writer's block?
Because if you're not doing one, you're doing another. I mean, there's always something to write about in one of the genres, so no, I've never experienced writer's block.
Okay. A little bit more about writing itself. At the end of your memoir, you say this: writing is a futile attempt to preserve what disappears moment by moment. If it is indeed futile, then what explains the production of 40 books in 40 years?
I'm still trying. memory is my muse in a lot of ways. Not always. I mean, I believe the requirement of the novelist is a combination of imagination and empathy. And when I write novels, I'm always writing about other people's lives. But I'm also often trying to mine history or parts of life that aren't known. Like, for instance, when I wrote about the French Revolution, I wrote about the women who were very important in it. And also, because I knew Robespierre and Danton, I knew them all in the movement, you know. The character types repeat themselves. I could do a very good job in that, but it also enabled me to deal with experiences I didn't want to deal with straight on. Remaking history, as I've done in all of my historical novels, exploring the underside of things, exploring what's been forgotten, the people that got pushed out of history. That's a form of memory. Another thing is that a lot of people that have been close to me have died, and the only thing that remains of them is what exists in memory and my attempt to create. I've written a whole lot of poems about my mother.
Okay, your mother. How did your mother, who was not a writer, and who had no college education?
She didn't even get to finish the 10th grade.
Yeah. How did she influence you to become a writer?
I don't know where it came from, but she was a very good mother for a young child. Once I reached puberty, it was hell between us, war. But she was a very good mother for a young child, and she played all these memory games with me. For her, she wanted me to be very observant. She despised people who weren't observant. So she was always testing my memory, and we'd play a lot of word games. She loved stories and words. So my mother was a good storyteller. See, there were three storytellers in my family. There was my grandmother. There was my Aunt Ruth, and there was my mother. My Aunt Ruth was halfway in age between my mother and me, because my grandmother had 11 children, there was such an overlap that my brother was the same age as my Uncle Danny. So it was just this enormous overlap. I mean, I think she had her last kid when she was 53 or 54. They would
tell the same story, all three of them, and it would become so different. My mother would tell it as sort of romantic drama. It was close to soap opera. Mm-hmm. My grandmother would introduce the miracle-working rabbis and the moral tone of it and so forth. And my Aunt Ruth would turn everything into a detective story that was very rational, and you had to have all the facts. And they taught me viewpoint.
Yeah. So that's how it started. And now you've been a writer and an activist for more than half a century. So let's talk about perspective. What do we take for granted today about our society that was considered unthinkable half a century ago?
I always have the understanding of what options were open to my grandmother. Die in a pogrom or get out. I think about the options that were open to my mother. She had to quit school halfway through 10th grade and go to work as a chambermaid to help support her family. What was her open to her? Marry a working class guy. She did it three times. Third time she was stuck in it. She felt she was too old to get another one. what options were there? She had no skills. She had no education. She was omnivorously interested in things. She would bring home huge books from the piles of books from the library every week, but she had no framework in which to keep anything. For me, look at all the choices. I decided I was going to college. I managed to do it. There were just so many more choices. And for people that are young now, well, it's closing down again. There's nothing like being stuck with student loans that are going to take you 10 years to pay off. So things close down a bit again, but we have to fight through that. Mm-hmm. But there's all sorts of things. You couldn't have imagined. There's a recent poem of mine that's going to be in the monthly review, which is about a young woman said to me, "How could you guys be so naive in the 60s to imagine we could have a revolution?" So I said to her, "Did you imagine, 15 years ago that there would be, that gay people, that women would be able to marry women and men be able to marry men? Now in five states, in Massachusetts, it was the first time." I mean, I live in a town in which the Board of Selectmen, which run the town, consists of my husband, who's a writer,
a fisherman, a shopkeeper, and very out gay man who lives with another gay man, and a gay woman who's had a baby with another lesbian, and that's who runs the town, small town. You think that Upton Sinclair, not Upton, the other Sinclair, Sinclair Lewis would have recognized that small town? I mean, that's changed enormously. There are many more options open for women. When I got pregnant, when I was 18, my only choice was either to have a baby and never finish college or do anything else, or abort myself. So I aborted myself and almost bled to death. I hope no other. I would love no other woman to ever face those kind of questions. The jobs that were open to me when I, when the house that I lived in when I grew up, Jews weren't white people yet at that point. All the covenants were no blacks, no Jews. I understood when I was a child that I wasn't white, I wasn't black, I was in between. And indeed, the only other Jew in the school was a black girl, Emily. And she and I were always put on hall guard together because it was felt we had more in common than we did with anybody else. And I grew up with a lot of anti-Semitism. And now it's coming back again, but it's less, at least it's not legal now. The jobs, you always used to say, you know, whites only, Protestants only, men only. You can't do that kind of gross legal stuff anymore. But it was all there when I was a child.
Well, this brings me finally to the subject of utopia.
Of course.
Yes. This is Eduardo Galeano's take on utopia. He says, quote, "She's on the horizon. I go two steps closer. She moves two steps away. I walk 10 steps, and the horizon runs 10 steps ahead. No matter how much I walk, I'll never reach her. What good is utopia? That's what. It's good for walking." What is utopia good for?
If you don't have an imagination of something quite different, you will only want more of the same. You want more Big Macs, you want more parking garages, you want more and bigger cars that use more and bigger gasoline, you want bigger and bigger Mac mansions. That's what you want. If you have to have a sense of alternatives, you have to have a sense. That's a lot of what science fiction and utopian fiction can do, is give you a sense of alternatives. Because if you don't have that, you can't ask for what you don't have, what you can't imagine. You have to be able to imagine something that you really want, the world that you want to live in, the world you want to leave behind you for who comes next. You have to be able to imagine that to be politically engaged in a useful way, and also to see if you can't see alternatives in your life, you're stuck. I learned that just arguing with my mother, who felt that she could see all the things that were wrong with sex roles, but she felt you couldn't change them. It's like trying to change the sky, she said. She didn't believe you could change things, so she was very afraid. If you can't imagine things to be different, how can you act in a way that will make something better if you can't imagine better?
And that's where the poets come in.
Poets and also science fiction, good science fiction can show you what Isaac Asimov said. I've written science fiction too, three speculative novels, it's including the utopian one you're talking about. It's all let's see. If this continues, what if this continues? And I've forgotten. My age, things drop out of my head. Let's see. Does anybody remember the Isaac Asimov quote? If this continues?
So what is your utopian vision?
Well, I put one down in Woman on the Edge of Time, which I was drawing on all sorts of facets of the movements of the time, what I considered to me the more attractive elements in both the New Left, the Native American movement, the various black movements, etc., and movements that weren't American that I knew about. Because when we were in SDS, we constantly were in touch with the other student movements. We knew the French guys, the German guys, the Japanese guys. Everyone came through. And I'd been in Cuba. I spent 3 months there in 68. I'd been in a lot of different places. I'd been in third world countries. So I had a lot of things to draw on. My not living in academia has given me the freedom to do a lot of things that most writers don't do. I've had a much more adventurous life, maybe a more dangerous one, but I have a lot of experiences that most writers now don't have.
Well, there's much more to say. There's much more that could be learned, but we do have to stop here. Thank you very, very much.
It says 000.
It says 000. So thank you very much.
And thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.